dating back to the spring of 2020, as a result of limited data released by the Cuomo administration, there has been rampant speculation about the number of New Yorkers in nursing homes whose deaths were tied to COVID-19. In recent weeks, though, that speculation has evolved into concrete evidence from the State Department of Health, spurred on by a report from State Attorney General Letitia James on the likely underreporting by the state, and a lawsuit for records from the Empire Center for Public Policy. Since then, the news has come fast and furious, including legislative movement to revoke the governor's pandemic powers, a rationale for the state's secrecy about nursing homes, and revelations about a federal probe of the Cuomo administration. To help us make sense of all these developments, we're joined once again by Bill Hammond, a former columnist with the Daily News, and now the Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, a fiscally conservative think tank based in Albany. So about a week ago, we had a private meeting between Cuomo administration officials, including the governor's top aide, Melissa DeRosa, and Health Commissioner Howard Zucker, with Democratic lawmakers who have been asking for months for information about the state's pandemic response, particularly as it pertains to nursing homes. And in this meeting, which happened less than 2 weeks after the state began releasing a fuller picture of nursing home deaths, Melissa DeRosa explains why they were stonewalling the legislature, saying they were responding to a federal inquiry, which required their attention first. What do you think of that excuse? And do we know what information was handed over to the Department of Justice or how burdensome it was to comply with that request?
That meeting was a remarkable moment in many ways. The backstory was that after that hearing in August, where they asked the commissioner for this nursing home information, but they also had, I don't know, 8 or 9 other questions that the commissioner couldn't answer them right away. And he said, well, I'll get back to you, which is common for commissioners at these hearings. They wrote a letter to him sometime in August, and it had a list of questions. I think both houses of the legislature each wrote their letters to the commissioner with a list of a laundry list of questions. And I think they were initially told, we'll get back to you in 3 weeks. Well, months went by. And so in addition to stonewalling my specific FOIL, they had been refusing to answer questions from the legislature. That stonewall started to crumble when the Attorney General's report came out in late January. And then I think our court decision kind of forced the health department and the Cuomo administration to take care of all the unanswered questions that they had on their plate. So on the night that our FOIL response was due, which was February 10th, I'd been told they would send it over at close of business. So it's 5 o'clock. I'm sitting at my computer. I'm hitting refresh on my inbox. Little did I realize that there was a Zoom meeting going on between Commissioner Zucker, the governor's top aide, Melissa DeRosa, a bunch of other top-ranking officials in the Cuomo administration, and then, I don't know, was it 7 or 8 Democratic members of the legislature
who had a particular beef with
how they were being denied information. And so it was this kind of weird, let's answer your questions, let's apologize for why it took so long, let's explain why it took so long. And in the course of that, one of the senators said, why are we just getting this information now? And Melissa DeRosa said, and it's been confirmed, they've released all the transcripts, that here's the bottom line, Senator, I'm paraphrasing, we had this inquiry from the Justice Department, and we had the president attacking us on Twitter for what we did in nursing homes. And we froze because we were worried that if we gave you the answers you were looking for, it was going to be used against us by federal investigators and by the president and by other of our political enemies. And that was an extraordinary thing to say on a couple of levels, because it wasn't a valid reason to withhold information. This was legal information that they were legally obliged to provide to the public, let alone the legislature, right? The legislature is a co-equal branch of government. It's not a good practice to stonewall them generally. And stonewalling them because you were worried about the political blowback is not a valid excuse. And the other problem with it is that it didn't seem to be true. The DOJ inquiry and the presidential tweet happened in late August. that doesn't explain why they weren't answering questions at the hearing in early August, and it doesn't explain why they weren't answering these questions in April, May, June, and July. The lack of information went way back before it became a political football, at least went way back before the Justice Department started asking about it.
And I was struck, Bill, in that transcript that's been released, how, you know, the Democratic lawmakers, aside from someone, Dick Gottfried, the Manhattan Democrat health chair, they basically just sort of roll with it. There's no, you know, that's a crazy explanation. No one protests during the meeting itself.
Well, I think the explanation was chosen strategically to appeal to the instincts of fellow Democrats who, if anything was going to unite them, it would be their disdain for President Trump and everything he represented. And they knew that the president had this habit of attacking people fairly or unfairly on Twitter. And so it was designed to provoke a sympathetic response, I think. I imagine that it doesn't show up in the transcript. I imagine there was a lot of eye rolling going on because they knew as well as anybody that their questions went back way before that issue arose. They chose not to, apparently most of them chose not to speak up about it during the meeting. But, I mean, you saw some of the quotes after the meeting. They did not accept her explanation. That initial inquiry, which came in late August, it focused only on government-operated homes for kind of technical legal reasons. It was a civil rights inquiry. It was about the civil rights of the residents, whether they had been violated. It was coming not from the criminal division, but from the civil rights division. And it only asked about government-operated facilities. There are less than 30 of those in the state out of 600 nursing homes. It's a small fraction of the nursing home industry. And so it was a relatively small amount of data that they were asking for. And from what was reported at the time, they were able to respond to that inquiry within a couple weeks. We don't know what they sent. I don't believe that's been made public. But they answered that initial inquiry in relatively short order. So, again, that doesn't explain why they didn't get back to the legislators or fulfill my FOIL request in late September or October or November, December.
We're discussing the latest fallout from New York's pandemic response in 2020. And our guest is Bill Hammond, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. So another element from that meeting, that private meeting earlier this month between the Democratic lawmakers and the Cuomo administration that I want to talk about has to do with a question that was asked about who in the Department of Health is advising Cuomo on his pandemic decisions. And this was asked to Melissa DeRoth, the governor's top aide, with the backdrop of a recent New York Times story revealing how frustrated staff of the department are about being sidelined during the pandemic. Can you explain who has the governor's ear, according to DeRosa?
It was interesting because she's asked about the Times story about a flurry of high-level departures at the health department, which was seen to be a sign of discontent, frustration, and feeling cut out. And her response was, I didn't recognize the names of those people. This conversation wasn't meant for public consumption, just in her defense, but she was pretty dismissive. And she did say something to the effect of, you know, the health department is great, but our contact with the health department is through Commissioner Zucker. So we're not talking to the rank and file in the health department. And then she mentioned a couple of the international and national experts that they have been talking to, and she named them. One of them is Michael Osterholm. I don't know all of the names.
Well, Dr. Fauci was one of them that came up. And I think the former New York City Department of Health Commissioner, who then went on to be the CDC director, was one of them. And I don't know. I mean, I personally wonder how involved they are in the day-to-day decision-making. I mean, she used them as references to how these micro-cluster zones were made in November. But it was an interesting narrative, definitely.
You know, I share your skepticism on that because I will point out we've never heard from them directly with respect to, with the exception of Dr. Fauci, with respect to any of these policy decisions. They haven't come and explained them to us. They haven't come and vouched for them. They haven't appeared at his briefings. He's dropped their names quite a lot, and I think he's paying them some money. And presumably they're providing advice. It's not clear that he's following their advice. It's not clear what he's consulting them on. And regardless of however much advice he's getting from them, he has a pretty expensive staff of thousands of people, many of whom are among the best qualified in their field, people with advanced degrees who do cutting-edge research. And by the way, their job is to be public health experts and to help manage, help respond to things like pandemics. It's a little disturbing to hear them dismissed the way they were in that context. And I think it's going to be especially disturbing for them.
So in the wake of this meeting, the Senate Democrats now claim that they're ready to amend the governor's pandemic powers, which go beyond what he might have had prior to 2020 to respond to a public health emergency. And they're proposing some sort of committee of legislators who will be involved in the decision-making process moving forward whenever Cuomo wants to go beyond those ordinary public health emergency powers. You know, I want you to weigh in on that potential oversight and how you think that might work. But first, what about the fact that the legislature's response to a issue that seems to be about transparency is to deal with this other issue, which has not been the subject, say, of the Attorney General's report or even your lawsuit? It's been about this lack of disclosure. I mean, are they focused on the wrong issue?
I mean, on a couple of levels, I guess I would agree with that. The Republicans lately have been hammering them to do subpoenas, which would be a gesture towards transparency. And their response, the tone of it has been, we don't want to focus on the past. We want to focus on going forward. And look at the 10 bills we're about to pass that will make things better in nursing homes. First of all, it's deflection. It's using your forward-looking action as an excuse not to hold people accountable and not to really explore what happened. Your solutions may not be well-founded if they're not based on the facts, if they're not based on a good understanding of the past. I think something similar is going on with this. It feels like a punitive action. It's a gesture of our dissatisfaction with the governor. But it is. It's kind of off point. The major sin that the governor stands accused of is withholding information, and you don't force him to reveal that information. You take away his video game access. You know, like I'm being a little flip. But it seems like the punishment doesn't fit the crime. And frankly, I think subpoenas would at least be a gesture towards transparency. I think if the governor wanted to regain the trust and credibility that he should have in order to have a good working relationship with the legislature, and not to mention the public, I think maximal transparency would be the way to go, just to prove that he doesn't have anything to hide and that he's willing to work in good faith with the legislature going forward.
And after a quick break, we'll hear more from Bill Hammond, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. When we get back, we'll discuss potential checks on the governor's pandemic powers, a new federal probe into the Cuomo administration, and the partisan critique of New York's response to the novel coronavirus.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people by keeping New York State union strong. UnionStrongNY.com for more information.
We're speaking with Bill Hammond, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, a conservative-leaning think tank based in Albany. And before the break, we were talking about whether the Senate Democrats focusing on revoking the governor's unchecked pandemic powers was the right move. So now I want to talk about their new plan for oversight, which they say could be voted on as soon as next week. What are your thoughts?
To be fair, I haven't looked closely at these proposals and I haven't talked to the people who are behind them. My initial reaction was, well, you know, the legislature is not known for being speedy about things. And by the way, there's a gazillion decisions to be made, some category of which could be considered to be exercising authority under emergency powers, and some category of which are the routine executive decisions that an executive makes. And drawing that line is going to be a little tricky. The governor, he comes across situations where he feels like he has to do things that he doesn't have statutory authority to do, and he writes up an executive order. So he has a clear sense of where that line is. But there may be a disagreement between him and the legislature on that. The governor is constantly adjusting the rules for, you know, how many people can be in a restaurant and when they can close and what kind of precautions they need to take in terms of cleaning, whether they can serve alcohol with or without food. And that's just one industry. And he's in the middle of rolling out vaccines, and he's making decisions about who's eligible and who's not, and which providers provide which vaccines. Some of those decisions are exercises of emergency authority, and others are just, you know, executive decisions that he would make. I mean, whatever happens to his authority, he's still the governor, and the health commissioner is still the health commissioner. They're the ones who are running the government from day to day. I'm a believer in the separation of powers, and I think the legislature should have been playing a stronger role even before the pandemic. I feel like they've been ceding too much of their power to the governor. But in a crisis, that's the one time you do need a pretty strong executive.
So it was reported late Wednesday night by the Albany Times-Union that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of New York is in the early stages of an investigation into the Cuomo administration that's focusing on the work of some senior members of the governor's pandemic task force. I think it's been made clear that at this point they're not, you know, going after any specific wrongdoing. But as you think about, you know, what might prompt this inquiry, is there any sort of, you know, activity or actions that we could infer might have been criminal in nature that are going on? Or is it possible that this is something that's below the surface that we don't even have any idea about that's going on?
If there's anything criminal, I don't see it. It's not obvious to me. There might, it may be that there's stuff under the surface that we don't know. I mean, the secrecy is sometimes a sign that there's something to hide. And a lot of people sort of react that way, that there must be something to hide, but we don't know what it is. And frankly, you know, it's mysterious what crime they would be focusing on. There was some intimation that it would be obstruction of justice because of what Melissa DeRosa said in that meeting. But I think a fair reading of that was she was primarily focused on the political blowback, and the fact that they actually did turn over information to the Justice Department indicates that it wasn't about denying information to investigators. We don't know what that information was. If there was some flaw, if that information was shaded in some way or was inaccurate in some way, that could be a problem. But there's been no allegation of that yet. Another issue here is that this kind of investigation is going to be a huge distraction for the governor personally, and it's going to be an ongoing scandal that the legislature has to worry about, the public and the media have to worry about. Similarly, if the legislature was to take on some kind of fight, like if they were to open an investigation or an impeachment fight or even to do subpoenas, all of these things are going to use up oxygen. They're going to occupy people's brains, and they're going to be distractions. It's kind of unfortunate that it's gotten to this place, because we still do have a pandemic to manage. We have vaccines to roll out. We have a fiscal crisis to deal with. And if the governor and the legislature are at war, or if the governor is under siege with a federal investigation and all of the political consequences of that, it's going to be a distraction. There's just no way around it. And I feel like there's a whole conversation we haven't had, not just meaning you and I, but the Albany world, the legislature and the governor, which is we need to do like an investigation of a disaster, a once-in-a-century disaster that befell New York along with the rest of the country. We need to understand why it got so bad and what we can do next time so that it won't get so bad. And that doesn't necessarily involve the details of who gets admitted to nursing homes. It involves much deeper questions about, you know, our preparedness for pandemics, the stockpiling we do, our ability to develop a test and use it, our ability to do contact tracing, things that really haven't gotten much attention. And there doesn't even seem to be a stomach for that kind of thoughtful inquiry. It's not about who's up and who's down. It's not about criminal charges. It's about understanding what went wrong and learning lessons.
What do you make of the fact that while Governor Andrew Cuomo is facing bipartisan criticism for his pandemic response, Republican elected officials at the state and federal level appear to give former President Donald Trump a free pass on the federal government's bungled response to the pandemic and various misinformation campaigns advanced by the president himself? Is that an intellectually honest critique by GOP lawmakers? Should Cuomo be the sole target of their ire?
Being at the Empire Center, my primary focus is on what happens at the state level. And so I certainly pay a lot more attention to that, and I write more about it, and I have more to say about it. But I'm aware that there were huge problems with the federal response, much of which traces directly to President Trump and his own peculiar way of going about politics that were especially disastrous in a pandemic. And that is definitely something you need to consider when you're trying to understand what went wrong in New York. But there were other things that were peculiar to New York. Our pandemic was worse than almost anywhere in the world. It does seem like a lot of people approach this like a zero-sum game. If Trump did something wrong, then Cuomo did less wrong. And if Cuomo did something wrong, Trump did less wrong. Like, I don't think that's at all the way we should look at it. It's kind of an unfortunate byproduct of our two-party system. But it doesn't make any sense. I mean, one of the more inane comments that I get whenever I say something about Governor Cuomo, the answer is, well, what about Governor DeSantis in Florida? I'm like, well, you know, what does that have to do with a decision that Governor Cuomo made? It doesn't make any sense, but it is unfortunately how a lot of people think in our hyper-partisan environment.
And finally, I want to discuss information you recently received from the state about nursing home deaths during the pandemic. But first, can you explain how you got that information? You mentioned earlier in our conversation that you had submitted a records request through the state's Freedom of Information Law, and that was initially ignored. But ultimately, you had to go to court to ensure compliance with that request. Can you explain the court decision that mandated this disclosure that was ultimately handed out?
Well, first, I should acknowledge we were not the only ones asking for this information. There were other people who filed FOIA requests. So the health department was stonewalling people across the board. The advantage that I had that other people asking for the information didn't have is that I had access to a lawyer. We have a relationship with the Government Justice Center, and part of their mission and part of our mission is to promote transparency. The Government Justice Center is a public interest law firm, essentially. So we brought the case in September. It was assigned to a judge at the end of October. The wheels of justice turned slowly. And it finally, the judge issued her ruling on February 3rd. It said, this is clearly public information. The health department has an obligation to disclose it. They've been in violation. They didn't have a valid reason for delaying this long. They're in violation of the Freedom of Information Law. They need to turn over the data within 5 business days, and they need to pay the Empire Center's court costs. So it was like, you know, the victory that we would have dreamed of when we filed the lawsuit.
What new insights, if any, have you been able to gain from this hard-fought data you and the Empire Center for Public Policy secured about nursing home resident deaths tied to the pandemic?
Well, I should say we're still doing the gleaning and the analysis, and there's probably more to be found and more to be said about that. But the initial pass at it, one of the first things I did was I checked to see how this additional data would change the shape of the curve. One of the things that's been missing up until now with respect to nursing homes is a day-by-day count. So you could see when the situation was getting worse in nursing homes and when it was tailing off. That mattered because back in July, the health department put out a report attempting to exonerate the March 25th policy that compelled nursing homes to accept coronavirus-positive discharges from hospitals, and which has been blamed, fairly or unfairly, has been blamed for contributing to deaths in nursing homes because you're bringing in somebody who's potentially infectious into a a facility that has a lot of vulnerable people. That became controversial. The health department did a report, and the key piece of evidence that they cited was the peak of deaths in nursing homes happened on April 8th, and that was too soon to be explained by the March 25th policy, because it takes a while after you've been exposed. It takes a while for you to show symptoms and get sick, and then get sick enough to die. So April 8th was too soon. I didn't find that particularly convincing, but that was the basis of their self-exoneration. That analysis relied on the partial data, which is kind of scandalous that they didn't use the full data for their own report. I wanted to know if you added in the full data, which I now had, would that change the date of the peak on April 8th? And the answer was no, it didn't. The peak was still April 8th. So that was one initial finding. And I guess I was also interested to know, overall, the hospital transfers were about one-third of the total deaths. And I was interested to know, were they concentrated at the beginning of the pandemic, or were they consistent throughout the pandemic? And the answer was they were more or less consistent. It's very difficult, looking at this data, to see the impact of the March 25th policy. First of all, because the data is limited to when people died, we only have limited data about when admissions arrived and how many and where. The AP obtained some of that recently, so that's going to be helpful in that regard. But my own take on this from the beginning is that policy was not the sole or even the primary cause of why things got so bad in nursing homes. Things got bad in nursing homes because this is a really dangerous infectious virus that we didn't understand well at the beginning. We didn't recognize it when it showed up. The question is, how much more difference did it make that the nursing homes were also expected to accept admission of coronavirus positive patients? It's sort of like this one of many factors that was contributing to the situation in nursing homes, and teasing out how much difference it made is difficult.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Bill Hammond. He is the Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, a fiscally conservative think tank based in Albany. Bill, thank you so much for giving this recap of the news. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thanks for having me on.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.